This is Philosophy 205, Contemporary Moral Issues. It is Thursday, March 31st, 2011, and we need to talk a little bit about making moral arguments before we get into talking about doctor-assisted suicide. Let's see, I'm going to get my pen out here. So we talked last time about a couple of issues, primarily moral relativism. So we talked about, we went over the syllabus and the course requirements, and just a reminder to students, if you, you haven't already, please log into Moodle and read the syllabus there, and make sure you've clicked on the class so I don't think about dropping you tomorrow. So even students in the in-class here, even though you've signed the roster, I'd like you to sign into Moodle so I can see that you've read the syllabus, because the only place the syllabus is in Moodle, and I want to make sure everyone understands the course requirements, and if they have any questions, they ask me, and that they are participating in the class and not just sitting there like a lump. So, where's my special pen? I didn't leave it in the classroom. I don't know where my pen was today.
Here's some pen. Oh, you
need
a board.
Yeah, I got my own special pen, but he's probably in the garage. What are the chances this has an ink in it? Better than nothing. Try the green one. Better than nothing. Okay. It's really lousy. Just give me one more second to run, just get my bag and see if I've got an extra one here. I think I left it in the classroom and someone walked off with it last time. Aha. So last time we talked about this idea of moral relativism. And moral relativism says that morality is relative to either to a culture, what the majority of a society believes, or relative to the individual, and where each person is his or her own moral law. Mm-hmm. And we talked about various problems with that. What counts as a culture? Where do you draw the lines to define the culture? And then all sorts of absurd consequences, like to find out how to solve any moral dilemma, look at a poll. as long as the majority of people in a culture believe and practice a certain thing, even if it's torturing babies for fun, gassing the Jews, cutting off the clitorises of little girls, etc., keeping people as property, and etc., etc., it's A-okay. Somehow, if you get enough people believing something and doing something, that makes it okay. That seems kind of weird. It's like what we call in ethics a counterintuitive consequence. We talked about the fact that moral progress is impossible. Generally speaking, people believe that we've come made progress in race relations, in gender equality, in human rights, and all manner of other aspects of society. And even though our society isn't perfect, you know, people no longer tolerate to the degree they did in the past racism, sexism, and classism to a certain degree, and in the past, for example, you can go back to the 19th century, where women were essentially the properties of their fathers or husbands, or you can go to the 20s, where you had, you know, women get the right to vote, but there's still this sort of gender apartheid, if you will. And then you can see as things move along with the feminist movement, and pretty soon women are, you know, getting educations, they're having careers, they're making more money than men, they're getting the majority of college degrees now, they have the majority of graduate degrees, and to the extent there is disparity in pay, there's all sorts of explanations for that which have nothing to do with sexism, which make up for in my view, most of the disparities between men and women. And this is, again, a topic we'll talk about later. Still vestiges of sexism, like women don't have to sign up for a selective service, so women, you know, cannot be drafted. women still, when they're putting those personal ads in, they want a man that's tall, right? They want the man to drive. You get women will ask men out on dates, but there is this sort of idea that, you know, there's some other things like paying for the date, right? It's still, there's still this sort of idea that if the guy doesn't pay for the date, he's cheap, and he's sort of expected to carry more weight. Men as primary caregivers for children, although, again, gaining acceptance, still get people kind of uneasy about it. Male nurses, becoming more and more popular as nursing is a kind of a growing profession, but still, you know, you have to have a pretty strong ego as a man, I think, to be a male nurse, just because it's a traditionally female profession. Even though I had a student in one of my classes, he was going to be a flight nurse, where you're essentially like an EMT in a helicopter. So you're like trying to operate on some guy while the helicopter's flying the guy off to the hospital. And usually if it's a medevac thing, you're dealing with somebody who's like within an inch of his life. He's bleeding all over the place. He's seizing up. And you've got to keep him alive long enough to get him to the hospital. And that's like a high stress, you know, high testosterone, if you like, macho profession, but you're still called a flight nurse, you know, and so it's kind of weird, right? So I'm not saying that there's no sexism, there's no racism, there's no, and there are no issues about in our society with regard to these questions, but it's still true that I think that we've made progress. But if you're moral relativism, you can't say that today things are better than they were before. That having people kept as property is better, is no better or no worse than they're not being. And so to have a notion of human rights, or to have a notion of natural rights, or God-given rights, if you like, to have any notion of rights at all that are universal, you can't be a relativist. And most people believe in some notion of human rights, that certain things are right and wrong, regardless of your culture. Now, what about like the individual? Maybe each individual is his own moral law. Well, again, then you run into problems like Ted Bundy or Charles Manson, or pick your favorite person who's really, really bad but not insane. Chairman Mao, Che Guevara. I always wonder about people that have these pictures of Che on their T-shirt. And, you know, he's a guy that bragged about executing people without trial. He was a pretty reprehensible mass murdering human being. You wouldn't go around with a picture of Hitler on your T-shirt, so why are you wearing Che? So, to me, that's a very interesting question, although perhaps a little off topic. But you think about a person who is responsible for the mass murder of individuals who bragged about executions without trial, and you think, well, that's a pretty bad person. And it doesn't matter if he thinks it's right, it's still wrong for him to do those things. So moral relativism, I think if you think about it deeply enough, is really an incoherent point of view. And the reason I talked about this the first day is I want to disavow this concept so we can move beyond it and get to what real ethics is about. And real ethics is about what's right and wrong. Not what's right and wrong for you, not your personal beliefs, not your feelings, but objective moral principles. Now, what might those be? Well, you can when you're making a moral argument, you might appeal to the sense of justice or fairness. This is what's behind like the idea that sexism is wrong. It's wrong to discriminate against someone, not because of something they did, but because of who their ancestors are. Why? Because you don't have any control over who your ancestors are. So if someone applies for a job and they answer their cell phone three times and nervously drum their fingers on the desk. They speak in ungrammatical sentences and they're dressed in an inappropriate fashion for the job interview, whatever it is. Then it seems like I would be perfectly justified in giving the job to another person. Why? Because this person exhibits qualities which would make them bad at this particular job, whatever it is. But if someone comes into my office and I say, oh, it's one of those people, whoever those people that I'm just have bigoted attitudes towards, and I reject someone because of their skin color or because because of their gender or because of their ethnicity or their religion or something, which have nothing to do with their ability to do the job and do it well, or their moral character or their fitness as an employee, then that seems to be unfair. That's an unjust way to treat people when you discriminate not based on character or performance or something someone did or is responsible for, but just based on some superficial characteristic which is irrelevant to whatever you're attempting to judge. And that has to do with this idea again of justice or fairness. Not necessarily that you treat everyone equally. I'd say the idea of treating everyone equally is kind of ridiculous. If you think about if someone, to take an extreme example, jumps out at you in a dark alley and points a gun in your face and tells you to give them all your money, you treat that person very differently than someone who meets you on the street and tips his hat and say, you know, how do you do, sir? Right? So, I mean, you don't treat everyone equally. But then there are circumstances where you react differently in different situations. But this idea that justice or fairness doesn't mean you treat everyone equally and with equal respect even, or with equal judgment. But it just means that you treat people appropriately. Another example, this sort of a contrary idea, what's best, or the common appeal to the common good, sometimes called the utility. Making the world a better place. And so a lot of moral arguments come down to what would be best for society. And sometimes that runs contrary to justice and fairness. So sometimes if you want to be just and fair, that might not be what creates the best outcome. Or sometimes the best outcome, something that might produce the best outcome might be unfair to particular individuals.
What's the last word? Is it utility?
Utility, right. So utility it's a kind of technical term in philosophy. It comes from the philosophy of utilitarianism. Let's put that in here. Utilitarianism.
Is that the greatest amount of good for the most amount of people?
Yeah, the greatest good for the greatest number is the slogan of the utilitarians. And they say you should try to produce the best consequences. I'll put that down here. The best consequences. We're talking about justice and fairness. Maybe we'll just kind of lump these in and also talk about rights. And this might be something like deontology, which is the view of Immanuel Kant. And I won't ask you about deontology and Kant, but I would like you to know that there's these two general ways of thinking about morality. One's in terms of rights, and the other one's in terms of social utility or the best consequences. So you might say that, you know, everyone has a right
Sorry to interrupt again. What does it say on the top right? We can't see that as
Sorry. That's all right. Maybe I can press a button here. See, which button should I press? Let's try. You just need to zoom in a little bit, looks like. Set the zoom. How's that?
Good.
Okay, good. Thank you.
Okay, so it's deontology. So generally speaking, you can think of in terms of rights and responsibilities, or you can think about the common good. And people, when they make appeals when they try to convince someone of a moral issue, of their particular stance on moral issue, they'll focus on one or the other of these. For example, you might say, well, everyone has a right to determine whether they live or die. That if you own anything, you own yourself, and you have a right to self-determination or freedom. And the most basic freedom you can think of is you deciding whether you live or die. And so that seems to be, to many people, a basic right. On the other hand, if you politically allow people the right to die, then that might have some negative side effects for society. For example, some people might be euthanized who aren't quite ready to die, but because of financial considerations, greedy relatives waiting in the wings, doctors who are maybe focused on emptying some hospital beds, or have this sort of idea that quality of life is all that matters, and that it's best that a person who's suffering be put out of their misery. So, I mean, there's all sorts of ways in which this might lead to negative consequences or side effects where people who don't want to die or aren't quite ready to die are killed against their will. So then you have to think about, if that in fact is true, how am I going to weigh those two things? But those are the two flip sides of this argument about doctor-assisted suicide. One is this idea that you have a fundamental right of self-determination, a right of freedom over whether you live or die. And on the other hand, this kind of this idea that we don't want to create a system in which people are killed against their will, which is also a violation of their rights. So these are two general ways of arguing. And I don't know if we need to go into any more detail here, because I want to make sure we get to doctor-assisted suicide and the other issue which we have in the docket, which is buying and selling your organs. But when we get to that, you'll see there's a similar sort of idea. Well, do I owe my liver or not? Or does the state owe my liver? Does the state have the right to tell me I can't sell my liver? Or maybe a piece of my liver, or one of my kidneys, given that I can get by just fine on two kidneys. If somebody's offering me $20,000 for one of my kidneys and I need that money to go to college, then, what am I going to do? And if maybe I need that $20,000, what if I want to blow that $20,000 on hookers and cocaine, right? Is that my right? It's my kidney, right?
Probably not a good idea with one kidney.
What?
Probably not a good idea with one kidney.
Hey, but it's that's an interesting point. So I would say that'd be a really bad decision. But the question is, should force of law be used to prevent me from making that bad decision? Or do we say it's my kidney, my body, my choice? Yeah.
Well, it might be argued in saying that, you should have a choice, because if you do that, for the money, your health deteriorates. And then you can't take care of yourself, you essentially become a burden of the state in terms of,
Well, it assumes that the state's going to take care of me and my other kidney fails.
Right, like they were making the point of, them having life insurance and health coverage for the rest of their lives.
Well, what if we say the other guy, though? The guy I give the kidney to, suppose he's not going to go for the hookers and cocaine, he's going to take real good care of himself because he almost died. So... I get my $20,000 from my hookers and cocaine. He gets his kidney and gets to live. But then the state steps in and says, no, that would be wrong for you to sell your kidney. You can't go around selling your organs because we forbid it. And so the result is that guy dies and I don't get my hookers and cocaine. And maybe I go out, or maybe what I do is I go out and rob the 7-Eleven store and get the money from my hookers and cocaine that way and end up shooting a convenience store clerk. So you always get these unintended side effects when you make little changes and intervene and keep people from making these free exchanges. So it's important to see how you might change things up when you pass a law. But a couple of things on making arguments, making good moral arguments. So here are two things you can do: is appeal to these two things. I'm going to add a third category. So you have rights, the common good, and then there's also, you can appeal to empirical facts. And maybe I'll put non-moral empirical facts. Sometimes when you're talking about what's best, the moral and the non-moral kind of get smushed together and it's hard to distinguish them. But there is a distinction between the general moral principle of the common good and non-moral empirical facts. For example, to figure out, if we allow doctor-assisted suicide, what would be the consequences? We've had doctor-assisted suicide in Oregon, and in order to prove a case against doctor-assisted suicide, one of the things you could do is try to show that there's an uptick in involuntary euthanasia and people being killed that don't want to be killed. So you can look at statistics. You can look at how many people opt for doctor-assisted suicide. And it turns out, actually, that when you allow doctor-assisted suicide, people see it as a kind of a comfort, and they'll sign up for it. And then a lot of times they'll just decide to go with hospice care. But they like having this as kind of an assurance that if they get intractable pain, that they won't have there'll be a way out. That when things get really bad near the end, that they have that option when they have a terminal illness or something to have a doctor help them die in a peaceful way instead of, you know, suffering and dying in a horrible way. Yeah.
I thought
I'll get you in a minute. Go ahead.
I thought hospice care was basically
assisted. No, hospice care is just when you're not treated. So a hospice is a place where people with terminal illnesses go. They've forgone all treatment, but they're, no one's actually. And this, and you could consider that to be involuntary euthanasia. You could consider that to be passive euthanasia. Because it is this kind of weird thing. If you have cancer and you don't get the chemo, the doctor is really not doing anything to kill you, but you're letting yourself die. So that would be, you consider that to be an act of passive euthanasia if you're foregoing treatment. Sometimes people have signs in their bed that say, do not resuscitate. That's another example of passive euthanasia, where you're foregoing treatment with some sort of disease that's going to kill you and not doing something to prevent it. But a hospice is just a place where people go to die that aren't getting treatment. The disadvantage of hospice is you can only take so many drugs, when you're at the end stages of cancer or some painful disease. And cancer is one of the typical ones where people go for hospice, where the drugs really don't work anymore. And people are always in some pain, in some degree of pain. And so people suffer more. Now, they have a longer life, but they suffer more. Now, the nice thing about active euthanasia, where you're actually killing instead of letting die, is that you say goodbye to all your family. They give you a little injection. They probably shoot into your IV. And you go to sleep, and your pain goes away, and you don't go through 3 months of horrible pain, and you can go out on your own terms. And so that's sort of the advantage in that people suffer less. And given that most people believe suffering is bad, if you minimize suffering, again, appealing to the common good and what's best, and this means not only what's best, not only increasing happiness, might be one thing, increasing happiness, but also decreasing suffering. And somebody in College Grove had a question?
Yeah, I did. Well, what I was going to say about the assisted suicide is kind of the sweeping, they have to set a standard and say, okay, well, it'll be when it has 6 months or less to live. That was sort of on the ballot when that was happened in 94, and I know California did the same thing, but...
And by they, you mean the state government, right? Just to be clear.
Yes, to set standard, like who is a candidate for assisted suicide.
Right, they don't have to set a standard, right?
Well...
Just to be clear. I mean, when you say have to, it means it sounds like... If they're going to pass a law, they have to have... They could pass a standard. What if they just say that whoever wants to die is their choice? I mean to derail your question, but just what you said there
example,
is some,
what my
controversial.
Be, and California has done the same thing. My father, in May of 73, was given 6 months to live, told to get his affairs in order so he wouldn't be here for that Christmas. And he died in May of 81. He had two grandchildren in that time. And so I know there's extreme cases where you know someone's going to die within those six months. But to have such a sweeping... open-ended, how do you decide who, when, where?
Well, what if each person gets to decide for themselves?
Well, yes, okay.
So, I mean, like, why do I need a terminal illness to take my own life? It's my life, isn't it? Suppose I'm like Hunter S. Thompson, right? I've lived all I want to live, or maybe I'm just, like, really depressed. I'm just not really interested in living anymore. So I could like take a gun and blow my brains out and like leave a horrible mess for my family to find.
Exactly.
Or I could, you know, go into a clinic and talk to the doctor and he'd offer me counseling and I could say, I'm interested in counseling, I'm just ready to end it, and maybe they give me a 24-hour cooling off period, and then they'd say, okay, well, it's your life, I guess, go ahead. And the doctor would come in and you know, I'd pay him his fee and he'd give me the drugs and set me up in a room and that would be it. I mean, why can't I do that? As it is now, they'll arrest you and put you in the psych ward, and if you're intent on killing yourself, they're going to strap you down to a gurney and you end up in a padded room or something until you can lie well enough to get out of there, and then you can go jump off a bridge or blow your brains out and do what you're planning on doing before, typically.
Or botch it.
Or I suppose botch it. Now, a lot of times it's people that will sort of commit suicide, it's kind of a cry for help. People are desperate frame of mind, and there's this question about whether suicide is ever a rational act, and that's actually one of the considerations. When you think about making a free will decision, is a person who wants to take their own life, is that person ever in a rational state of mind so that they can make an informed decision? Yeah.
Well, not only that, but you're violating your most basic right of life. I mean, it'd be the same as like selling yourself into slavery. I mean, that was the example. I mean, the thing about decreasing suffering, then you're like in the guy talked about, like in the Declaration of Independence, you have life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. And so the pro-choice wants to say that, you know, you're limiting suffering is more important than being alive. And then they create another argument that's trying to say that being able to choose that option is somehow greater than life, when it seems like life, being the most basic right, shouldn't be violated even by yourself.
But it's your life.
Yeah, but it's a violation. It's like a violation of your most basic principle. And to a degree, it would seem irrational. If you want to violate your most basic principle, then you must be in an irrational state of mind.
Now, Isaac, you're a kind of young guy. Have you ever had a relative with a terminal illness?
Yeah, my grandma had cancer.
Damn, that's not going to work. So one thing I want to say, like, suppose like I was going to answer Isaac and I said, you know, Isaac, you don't know what it's like to have my dearly departed grandmother. She had cancer and she suffered for months and lingered on in the hospital. We go to visit her, and she'd like slip me little notes saying, you know, Jeff, kill me, right? She would say, please, just let me die. And the doctor said, now, Mrs. Jones, you know, they give her a sedative, and she kind of let go off the twilight and kind of twitch a little bit, you know. I'd sort of tell this modeling story about my personal experience, and I might make an argument about that. But what if I were to say to you, you know, you have no right. Let's assume your grandmother hasn't died of cancer. Is there someone in this? Is somebody here hasn't had a relative die of a terminal illness? Okay. So Kevin. So Kevin, I'm sorry you're not going to be able to participate in this conversation because you don't have any personal experience with it. So anything you might say is illegitimate. So don't even try. No. Why is that wrong for me to say that, Dan?
It's a righteous opinion.
Yeah, so does it matter? Is it, suppose he gives a cogent argument, he says, suppose Kevin says, well, if you look at the Netherlands, they've had assisted suicide for a long time, and it's led to very few people take the option, and there's no increase in involuntary suicide, and if you look at these statistics here, you'll see this bears out my argument. Would you say, oh yeah, well, your grandma's never died of cancer, so...
Well, that's just an ad hominem.
Exactly. So, just as a reminder, because I'm sure this is going to come up later, ad hominem. Anyone know what this means in Latin?
Attacking the care.
Against the man, or we could say in our more gender-inclusive world, against the person. But literally in Latin, this means against the man. This is when you attack the person in a way irrelevant to their argument. Now, there are cases where the individual characteristics of a person may be relevant. For example, if the person you're talking with is a pathological liar, and he tells you, gives you some item of testimony, you could say, well, I don't know if I really believe you because you're a pathological liar, and you've lied to me every day in the last 3 years about something or other, right? But typically, this is like, oh, you're a man, so therefore anything you have to say about abortion is irrelevant. Have you ever served this country, son? You don't know what it's like to fight in a war, and you peacenicks, you know. You get people that are pro-war, whatever war it happens, say the Iraq War. Maybe a veteran from the Iraq War, and suppose he's like pro-Iraq War, and he's like, did you ever serve this country, son? You know, then you have no right to speak on the war. Well, that's nonsense, right? So you get things on both left and right where people will attack the character or individual, you know, based on their personal characteristics, and they're really sidestepping the issue. This is like a form of the red herring, where you're taking the focus off the issue and focusing on the person who's making the argument. You know, if Adolf Hitler was risen from the dead, and or maybe a zombie or something, right? And he kind of staggers up to the board and writes 2 + 2 = 4. Are you going to say, well, that's not true because Hitler just wrote that on the board? No, because it doesn't matter who writes 2 + 2 = 4 on the board. It's true no matter what. The same thing's good with any kind of a cogent argument. It doesn't matter whose mouth it comes out of, right? I mean, if Kevin made a really good argument about, you know, assisted suicide, I could say, well, Kevin, that's a really interesting argument, and you're not entitled to give it. But let me just repeat it to the class, because my mother did die of cancer. And then I suppose I give exactly the same argument. Right. Well, that's obviously ridiculous because it's the same argument. So it doesn't matter where an argument comes from. So please avoid the ad hominem. This is a very common form of fallacy. Yeah.
Going back to the suicide being arguably an irrational decision, as far as self-determination and self-freedom is concerned, and I'm not trying to take sides or anything, but as far as...
Go ahead. Feel free to take a side.
I don't take a side. I'm just kind of throwing the idea out there. Why is taking sides. Why does someone have the freedom to be irrational? Even if it is an irrational choice, why is that? Why are they not free to do that?
Well, it depends on what you mean by irrational.
It's
sort of insane. So it's like, if you're making a free decision, that assumes that you understand the consequences. So suppose I decide to kill my grandmother because she's a werewolf. And the question, suppose I'm on trial for murder. And I say, the reason I killed my grandmother because she was a werewolf and she was threatening to eat the baby next door. It seems that I would be, you know, not guilty by reason of insanity if it turned out that, you know, you find my diary and it's like you see grandma's a werewolf and there's scary pictures and you know, and I've got, you know, there's lots of evidence, the fact that I really believe this. Because that wouldn't be a fully informed, rational decision. There's something wrong with my brain. So the question has something gone wrong with the mind of a person necessarily who would ever contemplate suicide?
But you said that suicide is... Some people argue that it is inherently irrational.
Right, yeah.
No matter if you're insane or not, it's...
Well, the question is, are you by definition insane if you're suicidal?
I see.
So, I mean, there's degrees of irrational and irrationality. So I'm talking about sort of being fully non-rational and such that you're not making a rational decision. You're doing something that's bad for you because you have a mood disorder, because you have some clinical, psychological, or maybe even chemical imbalance in your brain or something. And there's some questions over here for a long time, like you and then you guys.
I was just saying, isn't that fall back to what we were talking about on Tuesday with cultural relativism? I mean, just because we think as a culture that it's wrong to go kill yourself, it doesn't necessarily mean that it's not right to do so. I mean,
now, I'd say that shows cultural influence, but it doesn't necessarily show cultural relativism, in that cultural relativism is the philosophical view that if everyone believes suicide is wrong, or if a majority believes suicide is wrong, then it's wrong for Americans, essentially.
That's what I'm saying. I mean, that's why we're stepping in, though. We aren't going to say, don't do it. You know, I mean...
But there's a difference between American culture frowns on suicide, and that explains why people oppose it, versus if the majority of Americans oppose suicide, then it's wrong. that's what cultural relativism says. The other thing you're talking about, which is that different cultures have different beliefs about suicide, that's just a description of that different cultures have different beliefs about lots of things. But that's not cultural relativism. I just want to make sure that people understand the term cultural relativism is the which Poyman calls the dependencies thesis, I think, which is just the idea that what makes things right or wrong is what the majority believes. But I mean, it's a good observation that, for example, in Japan there isn't the same stigma on suicide as in America. In Mexico, there may be a larger stigma on it because it's a largely Catholic nation. And then there's other places like the Netherlands where there's less of a stigma for it.
Well, like my two grandmothers, my mom's grandma, so my great grandma, she was paranoid schizophrenic. She had dementia and the one Alzheimer's where you forget everything.
Mm-hmm.
And she was still happy as a clam. She loved to watch her cartoons in the morning and Murder, She Wrote. She was crazier than shit, but she wanted to kill herself. But even though she was still completely happy, like she'd tell me, oh, hey, I've never met you before. Like, oh, okay, grandma, yeah, you know, nice to meet you, my friend now. And then my dad's mom, my grandma Jeanette, physically was just ridiculously sick, but her mind was still there. And Grandma Millie would always ask me, oh, is it time for suicide? Kill me now. It's like, no, here's your cartoons. Whereas if my grandma Jeanette, who was completely there in her head, but sick and body-wise, if she had asked me, I probably would have helped her. I mean, not say I'd go shoot my grandma in the face, but I would, right, you know, be more apt to help her versus my grandma, who was so great, you know, but she still liked to live and watch her cartoons, and she was still happy. So where do you draw that, you know?
It's probably a rare kind of strange situation where someone seems happy but wants to die at the same time. Although if a person is, you know, really insane, then you might say that if they're not maybe capable of making choices for themselves.
Exactly.
And then it seems like, on the one hand, it makes sense to err on the side of life if the person seems happy. But then it gets tough when you think about, well, what if the person is both crazy and suffering? You know, so they can't make the decision for themselves, and they are in terrible pain. Then, you know, then what do you do? Do you say, oh, we're going to do this, we're going to euthanize you for your own good? And there was a bunch of hands up. I don't want to make sure I missed anybody. You guys, were you guys, I think I saw some people that were way over here that had their hands up earlier. I just want to make sure I don't have tunnel vision on you guys here. Why don't I get to you guys and I'll get to you guys. So there's a couple of hands over here. Go ahead.
Yeah, I was just going to respond to the thinking, like this assisted suicide being a completely irrational decision.
Mm-hmm.
Universally, like suffering or not. And I think that it's not entirely irrational. Like, I think that it's like they broaden their viewpoint, like other than just themselves, to everybody around them, that suicide occasionally can be completely rational. Because say you can't hold down a job, so become a financial burden to your family, or you go batshit crazy and start killing people or something like that, and then you get put in prison or psych ward and you become a burden to every, like the US that pay tax dollars, because then my tax dollars go to some crazy person who went on a killing spree because he couldn't commit suicide or something like that, and then their family won't let them do it. And I think that, I don't know, I think like it's not just about the person, like it is to a point, but I think that you have to look at everything else that it affects, like their family, their friends, and so on and so forth.
Maybe we'd have less people go on these rampages if we had, you know, assisted suicide clinics where people could walk in, maybe get some counseling, and if they decided they're ready to go through with it, then instead of like shooting like up a shopping mall and then shooting themselves in the head at the end, you just, you know, they go into the clinic and are able to escape their pain, and nobody else has to die. Way over in the corner there.
I just had a question that people keep saying that it would become a burden to the state or the nation, but isn't the point of the nation and the state to take care of the people?
That's a really good question, and that actually appeals. This actually hits on like a larger theme of this class, which is this question of moral versus legal. Let's see, where can I write?
Oh, I can write over here.
So what is the legitimate function of government? How far should the laws reach? What is the purpose of government? I mean, some people have this idea that the government is sort of like a super parent that is there to take care of us from cradle to grave. Other people have this idea that the government is a what's that?
Boogeyman.
Well, the boogeyman. I mean, that the government is a kind of has a police function to keep us from killing each other and to protect life, liberty, and property, and that other than that, it has no use. Other people say the government has no use, period, and that people are only dependent on it because society hasn't evolved sufficiently to realize that government is the, you know, monopoly use of force, and that people haven't learned to quit killing each other, and maybe once we get to a minimalist state, we can sort of get rid of the last vestiges of it and live in a free society, which doesn't run on coercion and fear, authority, and so on. But I mean, you raise a good question, like what is the purpose of the state? And that is in some ways going to determine on whether you think laws forbidding assisted suicide are legitimate or not. Let's see, and then you guys over here. Yeah, let's see. I should know your name, but I don't. What is your name again?
Nick.
So I was thinking about this, actually talking about this rather recently, about a year ago. My grandmother passed away. Similar way to my grandmother was outside, spent the last 6 months of her life in a nursing home, and in bed, couldn't do anything, was down to like 60 pounds, heart condition, and I was like, there's no way that I would be willing to live like that. It's just painful to watch something like that. And I just, like, no, I mean, at that point, like, life is, in my opinion, is not worth living, so I think at that point, a choice does make sense, and I would just go crazy if I was.
And you might think that would you have the view then that, like, you would want that option of assisted suicide, but you wouldn't necessarily impose it on anyone else. That should be their choice, and then there might be some people who for them, it's more important to continue living even if they're in pain or even if they're, like, debilitated. So maybe they're not in pain, but they're not mobile or they have some severe disabilities. That might be a worthwhile life to them.
Yeah, I mean, I think people should have their choice in the nation. Your life is severely compromised now. You must end your life. No, the choice should be there. But I just know from somebody who likes to, you know, like to run, runner, you know, hike and dance and all that stuff. If I was just confined to a bed and I couldn't do anything for the rest of my life.
See, like, and like to someone like me, that's not important. Like, you know, if somebody said, okay, you can be crippled, blind, or deaf, I think I'd choose. It's like, you know, we can amputate your legs at the knees, or we can, you know, make you deaf or make you blind. I think I'd go for the legs first. Because for me, my senses are important, but for me, it's more important to be able to think and experience and, like, moving around, not a real sort of, you know, active outdoorsy person, as you might be able to tell. So, but you know, so it might be that this comes down to an individual's what a person values. Not that there aren't any moral absolutes, but that people have matters of personal taste, and your personal taste might not be the same as mine. If to you life is all about hiking in the woods and you know and playing sports and running around in the open air, and for me it's sitting in front of the computer. I can sit in front of my computer with no legs. You can't run around in the forest or play sports or whatever with no legs.
It'd be easier to get prosthetic legs and ability to get a set of eyes or ears.
Yeah, I suppose. So, I mean, again, make me, like, paralyzed or something like that.
Yeah,
I think I'd pick paralysis over, say, being deaf, for example.
Yeah.
And that might be the same for a musician or something. Let's see, there was a couple other hands. I want to make sure I get everybody, you and then you.
My 10-year-old daughter's great-grandma was diagnosed with dementia 3 years ago, and it went downhill so fast that last week she actually passed. But for the last month of her life, she was in hospice, and she was in a bed. She fell out. She broke her hip. She couldn't talk. Like, the only thing you can see is, like, basically her soul and her eyes. Like, that's it. They, for the last 2 weeks, didn't give... She wasn't on anything. She wasn't on support. They weren't giving her IVs. Nothing. Except for morphine. Is that not assisted suicide?
There's this kind of fine line, like a similar story. The person who actually taught the class before me, she had these, like, these stomach pains, and she didn't like going to the doctor, so she put it off. All of a sudden, the pain went really bad. It got really bad. She went to the doctor, and they said, "Well, you've got colon cancer, and it's spread so far it's inoperable." So she went to the hospital, and the last couple of months is like basically they give you a morphine drip, and they give you a little button, and they say, when the pain gets really bad, press this button, and you'll get more morphine. And you basically press the button until you go into a coma. And then they wait for you to die. And I'm thinking, if that was me, I'd say, okay, well, how long is this probably going to take? And they say, well, 3-6 months, something like that. The pain will get really bad in 2, such that you'll probably be, like, floating out of consciousness. And I'd say, okay, well, I'm going to give myself, like, I'll give myself another month, and I'll invite all my relatives to come, say goodbye, and I'll go out, and then they just give me an injection, and I get to avoid not only the last month of excruciating pain and semi-consciousness, but also you avoid the extra expense for the insurance company or the state or whoever, just keeping your corpse alive while you're in a medically induced coma waiting for your heart to give.
That's kind of what they were doing for us. Like, that's really mean, it's basically like dehydrating yourself. That's painful enough.
And it might be that people that die of dehydration may be experiencing some form of pain. It's difficult to tell. There have been people who've been in comas who report having bouts of wakefulness, where they're aware of things and what's going on around them, but not be able to do anything about it. So that's kind of a scary idea. Yeah.
I think there's a huge Christian influence on, obviously, the decision to make assisted suicide or ban assisted suicide. But I find it ironic that there's no state intervention when it comes to certain religions having the right to deny their 5-year-old little girl a life-saving surgery because she might have to take blood, which is essentially the same thing, right?
I think that actually is that would be a case of child abuse. I mean, people have been prosecuted for that sort of thing. Usually, either Jehovah's Witnesses or Christians Science. I want to make sure we take our break because we're a little overdue. So I will get to all you hands. Raise your hands again when we start, and I'll take you guys right after the break. Take 10.
Yeah,
I'm serious.
Everyone, please give Coulter their undivided attention.
I was just going to kind of go back to what the book was talking about for assisted suicide, how the Netherlands, I don't know, is it legal there or just accepted?
It is legal there.
Legal, so how they're saying they have lower rates of it actually happening. I think that would actually happen in the U.S. as well because, suicide to some people in major pain and suffering is good on paper, to end it. But when it really comes down to, just metaphorically pulling the trigger, it's kind of hard to make that decision. I had a friend in high school, and his mom, and this is well before I was born, but she attempted suicide. But as she was pulling the trigger, she backed out and ended up shooting herself in the face. And so, you can make that decision, but it's really hard to follow through on it, I mean, for a lot of people. So I think that would actually deter the number of incidents that would actually happen.
And there's this whole idea of minimizing harm.
Yeah.
So if you think about, if you want to minimize harm, you might stop people from like crippling themselves for life if you say, here's a process you can go through where the state will allow you to kill yourself, and we're not going to cart you off to jail or put you in a padded cell. And as a matter of fact, as part of this process, the person comes in and says, I want to suicide, and you say, okay, first talk to this head shrinker, right, who's going to see if we can solve your problem some other way. And then this person is going to give you all sorts of education about hospice care, about, maybe new treatments for your disease, about, other considerations, and then maybe there's a cooling off period. And so if you don't make the process too onerous, you might be able to kind of do an intervention, and then at the very least, that person, even if they decide it's not for them, they go through the process, they have this sort of sense of comfort that the option's available if they really need it, and that might even help a person who decides not to go for it to go through those last few months of life. I want to take people in order. Is there anybody else that had their hand up before the break? A couple of people over take things over here. I'll just go this way. Nick first.
So I took a deviant behavior here, Walter, And there, I guess there were several things about suicide that were kind of interesting. A lot of people commit suicide subconsciously as a way of getting back those who feel that have done them wrong.
Or consciously. I'll show them, right?
Yeah.
You know, the girlfriend that jilts you, you know, I'll show her, or your family that is always so demanding or whatever, yeah.
But also, women will attempt suicide more, but men are more likely to pull a period out.
Right. That is an interesting difference there. And often it's a kind of a, it kind of goes along with, again, not to draw a broad, with a broad brush, but women generally tend to be less aggressive and engage in more what we would call passive aggressive behavior. And so you have a behavior which is sort of non-overt. It's kind of, as they say, a cry for help. Whereas men, they've decided they're going to do it, they put their mind to it, and they carry it out. And generally speaking, yeah.
Women are more likely to, I guess, overdose on pills, which may or may not.
Right. Right, you can, if somebody finds you, they can pump your stomach and be saved. Gunshot to the head, people do survive those, but it's a lot less, or jumping off a bridge or something like that. The men tend to favor guns. And I don't know what else I didn't think about. I thought about giving my brother this. There's this book, Final Exit, by Derek Humphrey. He actually lives in Junction City. I had him as a guest of this class about, I guess, 5 or 6 years ago. But he has this book, Final Exit. It's a suicide manual, essentially. And it talks about all the painless ways to kill yourself and how to do it right the first time. And I thought about giving this to my brother as a gag for Christmas one year. But then I'm thinking, oh, what if he's in a bad state and he goes through with it? Boy, will I have egg on my face.
So,
Final Exit by Derek Humphrey. H-U-M-P-H-R-Y, no S. Derek Humphrey, Final Exit. It made a big, this was like around the time, I guess, Kevorkian got notoriety, maybe a little bit before, like in the early 90s, it was a controversial topic. Let's see, moving along. What's your name again? Trying to learn some names.
And though
Cassie.
I'm for physician assisted suicide, and I kind of think that it would, along with what you were saying, because a lot, and I don't know the exact number, but a lot of suicide attempts are basically just a cry for attention. Look at me, help me, help me. And I think if they were actually posed with, well, you want help that bad, walk your ass down the block and go seek Kevorkian, I think it would kind of be like, okay, I'm sorry, I'm a dumbass. You know, of course you're going to get the ones that are going to walk in there and do it, but that's your right. Go ahead. Knock yourself out. And then, of course, the religion aspect comes into it, which that's a whole other can of worms. But I think it would decrease, like in another one. I don't think it would be used that often.
This is an interesting case, and abortion is another one. By the way, for the reading for next Tuesday, we're going to talk about abortion. And I think on Thursday, I'm going to try to get to some economic issues. And I'll have some handouts up this weekend, and I still haven't decided. I'll decide on Tuesday whether I'm going to pass them out or not, or I'm just going to ask you to read them on Moodle. But I'll have them up. I'll have some of my handouts on Moodle this weekend about economic issues, since we have tax days coming up. Let's see, what is next Tuesday is going to be the... Well, I'm trying to think of the days. 7th. So that's a week ahead. I'll tell you abortion. I'll say abortion on Tuesday, and I'll have like the next 3 weeks' topics up there this weekend.
What topic is on the board?
So it's is abortion, what is it called? Is abortion immoral? It's under gender, sex, and reproduction debate. Is abortion immoral? Issue 4. Don Marquis and Margaret Olivia Little. So read issue 4, and I'm guessing we'll take the whole class. Abortion is a very complex issue, so we might take the whole. I think we're probably going to take the whole class for that. So abortion on Tuesday, and this weekend I'll put the next few weeks' topics in Moodle. I'm still trying to arrange some topics with some timely events and guests and events and things.
April 15th falls on a Friday.
Right.
Next Friday.
Right. So I want to do that. I want to do those topics like on the Thursday before at least. So that's actually, I think it's a week off. So I might push those off till the following week. But just read the abortion article for Tuesday. And again, I'll have those readings up for the next few weeks in Moodle this weekend. Where were we?
For me personally, like I think the physician assisted suicide in terminal illness, I guess is a good thing. I don't want to call it good, but I mean it's a way out for people to, you know, alleviate their pain and their suffering. But for me personally, because of the afterlife beliefs that I have, I wouldn't want suicide to be the last decision that I made personally. Mm-hmm. But I think that for terminally ill patients, it's a good way out for them. I mean, I'm not terminally ill, I guess. Uh-huh. Like he said, I technically am. I'm every day getting closer to death, but right now I don't think I have cancer or anything. So, but if I were faced in that situation and I could consciously make the decision, would I commit suicide or not? To me, suicide is suicide. And because, like I said, of the afterlife beliefs I have, I don't think it's the right thing to do. And
so you think God takes a dim view of suicide? Or?
I do. Mm-hmm.
So, can I ask if you're Catholic?
I was raised Catholic. I'm actually not a practicing Catholic. I don't believe in organized religion.
Okay.
And I take bits and pieces out. It's more of an afterlife thing, what I think I could come back
to. I'm trying to imagine. I'm just thinking about, because typically, Catholicism has
Catholicism
this.
Catholicism and
considers, yeah, Catholicism that. Considers suicide to be a sin.
And Buddhists believe that you'll come back seven terrible lives if you commit suicide.
Right. Most of the, although if you look at like some of the other, that's like later Buddhism. Mm-hmm. Early Buddhism really doesn't have a stigma on suicide. So it depends on what kind of Buddhism you're looking at.
No. I know. I'm just saying that for my personal beliefs, I wouldn't want suicide to be the last decision that I made. Do I think it's appropriate in these types of situations? Sure. But I don't think that talking about having like a assisted suicide clinic for people to walk into and be able to take a lethal injection of something, I think that's ludicrous.
Oh, wow.
That's
that,
just my personal opinion.
Now, you keep on saying personal opinion or personal beliefs. I mean, do you think your beliefs are true?
No, my beliefs, to me, they are true, but I don't expect everyone
to agree with me. Well, I mean, do you think they're, when I say true, I mean representing reality.
My reality, yeah.
But how many realities are there?
A million, billion, trillions.
So which reality does this pen exist in?
This reality.
Okay, how about the assisted suicide clinic? Does that exist in this reality too?
No, it doesn't, but I...
Right, there isn't that. But suppose I were to start an assisted...
I felt like it kind of went off. Like, for me, physician-assisted suicide in the articles that we were reading is about people being terminally ill. And then if you're talking about having a physician-assisted suicide clinic for people to go into because they're a burden on society,
this religious angle, I mean, to me is interesting because a lot of the attitudes about suicide seem to come from a religious place. Mm-hmm. It seems that if you have religious beliefs, they aren't just about what happens to you as a person when you die. People who have beliefs, they tend to be general beliefs about what happens when a person dies. Typically, people don't think their views of the afterlife only apply to them in particular. So, assumedly, if someone else commits suicide, you think there will be some bad consequences for them in the afterlife, right?
I choose to not push my religious beliefs on it.
I'm not talking about whether you want to like push them on it, but I mean that.
Don't you?
So the question is that given that you have that belief, and suppose like some Democratic vote comes up or something where you get to vote for assisted suicide clinics, should Oregon allow not only doctor-assisted suicide do you have a view about doctor-assisted suicide, whether it should be legal or not? Or
I feel like when we're talking about, it's like a two-way street for me.
Uh-huh.
When you're talking about like a assisted suicide clinic,
yeah,
of course I don't think, but when you're talking about terminally ill, very sick people who are in a lot of pain, then yeah, I think
okay.
It should be legal.
But it seems that your view is like, I have these views about what happens when a person when they die, but I understand that other people don't have those views, so therefore I'm not going to use the state to force people's choices in a way that goes contrary to their beliefs.
I think what you're saying
that they could do the physician-assisted suicide. The reason I brought my own personal beliefs to do it is because it's something that I would not do. But
right.
Do I think that other people have the right to make that choice? Yeah, I do.
Okay.
It's just like abortion to me. Do you have the right to make that choice? Of course.
Is it the same with slavery?
Like, you think abortion should have the right to
choose? Yeah, I'd say abortion is an analogous case, but we'll get to that later.
Well, I mean, they compared the two in the article. They talk
right,
about
well, I mean, that's a questionable comparison, but well, I don't want to get into the abortion legal.
Do people have the right to make that choice? Okay. Yeah, they do. Do I agree with it fully? No.
Right, but I want.
Would
I mean,
I do that? No, I wouldn't.
Yeah, I just want to make this distinction. When people say, like, these are my personal beliefs, or this is my personal view. I mean, you don't have to add personal. Those are just your beliefs, mm-hmm. and your beliefs aren't just about you. They're about the world.
Yeah.
So.
Well, and that's why I sat here for a little while, kind of slowly,
right, yeah.
because I wasn't exactly sure how we were to approach this. I don't want to say my personal beliefs, but it's that's why I kind of sat here for a little while. I wouldn't do
well,
this.
Do you have any impersonal beliefs?
Huh?
Do you have any impersonal beliefs? So, I mean, they're just your beliefs, right?
Yeah, they're just my beliefs.
And they're not beliefs about you. They're not beliefs about, like, you as an individual. They're beliefs about the world, about mm-hmm. the spiritual world,
yeah.
about what happens when we die.
Yeah.
So I just wanted to be clear on that. So that, and a big question in the class is, if we're going to have a democratic system and a government, you know, it seems that you can go one of two ways. You can say, well, you should have separation of church and state, and most people agree with that. But then the question is, when you have a democratic vote, are you going to say the religious people can't vote? And then the question is, what should be up for a vote, and what should be, you know, a matter of law that can't be changed by democratic vote? And those will be issues we'll talk about later on. But maybe we've gone a little astray here. But the bit about religious beliefs do seem to have a strong effect on the way people think about these things. But if you look at many religious traditions, don't have any prohibitions against suicide. Judaism doesn't really. King Saul committed suicide, and it's not seen as a bad thing. In Japan, you commit seppuku, and if you dishonor your family, and that was seen as not only something which was allowed, but it was seen as a moral obligation for you to do.
Kind of like a state
of grace. So it is a particularly. It's generally a Catholic thing, although to a lesser extent, other Christians have different views, but sort of are kind of squeamish about it. There's nothing in the New Testament specifically against suicide either. Although people will say, well, there's prohibitions against murder, and suicide is murdering yourself. So I don't. I'm not sure if that's a. That in some ways seems to be playing with words to me. But I see you had your hand up.
I was kind of going along the same lines. You know, I'm in pain, and I mean, no offense, but I don't really give a shit about your beliefs. I'm hurting. I want to be put out of my misery. So why is it that somebody else's belief is going to keep me from doing that?
I didn't say that, though. That's not what I said.
Well, theoretically,
my belief was, and that if there was a vote up that said, would you vote for this? Yes, because I believe you have the choice to make that decision. I don't.
But you would draw the line at the clinic.
But where I'm drawing the line is that a lot of people that say the same thing that you're saying are preventing me from being able to do what I...
No. Nobody's preventing you from killing yourself.
Well, there's this...
Just making it legal to kill yourself.
Well, I'm saying other people. I'm not saying her.
No, but I'm saying theoretically, if anybody really wanted to kill themselves... No law is going to stop
that. Well, then
I'm in a position and I don't have legs or arms and I can't kill myself, and more than likely I can't do it myself. Somebody has to do it for me. Therefore, that's where the food is.
Sure. Well, I mean, so you're going to go, what, either to family, friends, or law?
Can I? What if I can't speak? I mean,
how are you going to get so many? All right, one at a time. We want to avoid again. Keep this in an academic discourse and not try not to be too inflammatory with our language here.
Yeah,
way in the back.
I was just wondering, are we distinguishing between position assisted suicide for just
froze the last few minutes?
Real patients or for just
anybody? Oh, I didn't notice.
Yeah. I think I'm going to have to reboot this thing.
Okay. Sorry, make your point again.
Are we distinguishing between position assisted suicide just being for terminally ill patients or being for whoever wants to participate in such a program?
Well, that's a good question. I think, what was your name again?
Amanda.
Amanda was making a distinction between terminally ill people having the right to have a doctor help them die because they've only got 3 or 6 months or a year anyway, versus a suicide clinic where anyone who says, I'm ready to die, can walk in. Was that the distinction you were making?
Mm-hmm.
Well, what's wrong with having a clinic where anybody can walk into? And how is that any worse than than having it just for somebody who's terminally ill.
Yeah, I would say
if you're not terminally ill but you're suffering, you're still suffering. Why wouldn't you have the right to choose to have a physician help you? It'd be so much better. It's better than any other method of killing yourself. It actually would work first time, and you know.
I mean, that's a legitimate question. I think that the assumption, is there someone that wants to address that direct question?
Yes.
Go ahead.
Sorry.
Go ahead.
I mean, I feel that, you know, if you're dying of whatever disease, you know, that's one thing, incurable. You know, watch my own two grandparents suffer old age, whatever, heart failure. But if your wife leaves you and is having an affair with your boss, and you're like, I want to die now. It's like, no, things can be overcome. And I don't think that's not a limit. You may feel like killing yourself at that one given point, but you will overcome that. It's not, it's different. So I guess I wouldn't want to see people killing themselves for things like that. You know, one of the traumatic things in their lives, they feel like dying at that moment.
Yeah, the idea is that you're going to get better. All the time heals all wounds, right?
So, I mean, I don't think that suicide should be allowed.
Okay, rebuttal there in the back. Yeah, you're shaking your head. It looks like you're chomping at the bit to give a rebuttal.
Well, it's ridiculous to think that just because you have a little life situation, you're going to get over that. If you're suffering, you're suffering. It's not something that you recover from.
Have you been on a broken heart, though? And wanted to die, and then two months later,
thank God
there wasn't a clinic.
And 8 months later, still wanted to die, and 3 years later, still wanted to die, and it's been 15 years,
well,
and still wants to die.
Well, then I bet you will vote yes on a clinic. But I've had a broken heart quite a few times, and I was like, oh my God, I want to die. Did I get over it? Yes.
But what if it's something really traumatic, though? Like you plowed into a family of five when you were out driving drunk. And you can't, but suppose you've been to therapy for 3 years and you can't get over the looks of like the baby that was cut in half in the back seat or something. I mean, people have horrendous things that happen to them and they end up in a way where they have psychological problems and pain that aren't going to go away anytime soon.
Okay,
they're gonna be with them for
then there would have to be some kind of steps that, okay, you would have to go through this much psychiatry and this much this, and if nothing worked, absolutely nothing, fine. You're going to go shoot yourself anyway, so you might as well not make a mess and donate your body to science. Okay. You know, there should be some steps in there. It shouldn't just be, okay, I'm going to walk in and, you know, do me up. There should be some kind of... there should be some kind of...
I hate the light. I got a bunch of hands. I got a bunch of hands over here.
Thank you.
You want to join?
Okay, good. Welcome back. I got the recording, and it'll be on Moodle, so you can get the choice bits that you missed. That's really good stuff,
good.
Though.
Well, I figured you guys probably had snacks, too, huh?
I want to get to you, who's had his hand up for a long, long time. Speak loudly, please.
Okay, well, before it got really kind of out of control, this might be off of what everybody's saying here.
So. A second.
Dang it.
What's your name?
Rob.
Rob.
Yeah,
Rob has the floor.
Yeah, just had a question. My best friend's dad kind of just recently passed from cancer, and he was on machines for a couple weeks. So this could be a different subject altogether. They were talking about possibly if he made it from the situation he was in, would they want him to be in a state where he was just kind of a vegetable, when he was kind of like the guy who threw the parties, left a barbecue for everybody, you know? So who is it for them to decide? Who, you know, I mean, to like unplug the machines when he has a chance? I mean, I was sitting in that hospital for almost 2 weeks there, and I was like, man, if this is my family, I'd be there for them. I couldn't make that decision unless it was in writing saying, yeah, if I was ever in this situation, I wouldn't want my family to go through. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and I'd say for anybody in this room that is important to you,
so is that,
whether or not you live or die, go home tonight, write up a little letter that says, if I'm ever in a vegetated state, kill me. Or if I'm ever in a vegetated state, by God, don't you kill me because I might make it and I want to live. So whichever way it is.
Is that still considered, you know, if you're kind of like on a machine and they unplug it, you die? I mean,
right.
Is that considered?
That's
doctor assistant?
And that's kind of a weird one because that's what sometimes is called non-voluntary euthanasia, because it's not involuntary. It's not like you got the pillow over somebody's head and they're like, I want to live. And it's not, but it's also not like the person says, you know, I want to die, kill me now. It's like they're in a vegetated state. They didn't tell anybody. There's no written directive. And so there's a big question mark about what the person would have wanted done. And usually the choice goes to the family.
So what does life mean? Does life mean, you know, walking around, or if you're just...
Well, I'd say, like, I mean, there are certain cases where the chances of coming back are infinitesimal. And so in those cases, you might think, well, it's just, you know, just keeping a body alive when the person isn't going to come back to consciousness. And so it seems like you're just wasting medical resources would be one view. But I'd say that's those are the tough decisions. And so one practical application of this class is, if you have definite views about whether you want to be euthanized or not, should you be ever be in a persistent vegetative state, you should write down what those directives should be, who you want making the decision in case your decision isn't clear. Sign it and have a couple of friends or family members sign it and put it in a safe place and tell people. Or at least let your wishes, if you don't go that far, at least let your wishes be known. Although written directives are, you know, if you want something that's certain, that's going to work. And if you really want to get crazy about it, you know, go on the internet and find, there's forms you can find to download for that. Again, either way, whether you would want to be euthanized or whether you would want to have every possible chance to live. Isaac.
All right. I just kind of wanted to talk about there was a section, page 292, that had talked about the expanded definitions of terminal illness.
Uh-huh.
And I wanted to touch on, like, these assisted suicide places. They give very broad and general definitions on what it means to be terminally ill. And during the break, we talked about, you know, how essentially everybody is terminally ill because everybody's going to die eventually. It's inevitable. But where do you draw the line on what is considered terminally ill? Is it a physical illness? Is it a disease? Could it be psychological? Could it be emotional? I mean, once you establish that it's okay to kill somebody that's terminally ill for, say, cancer, even though technically you don't know when they're going to die. You can assume, right. You can make observations, but you really don't know when they're going to die. So to say that they're terminally ill and that they're okay to die would... as you put, like, would be a slippery slope or a loose cannon to saying, like, well, somebody has a psychological impairment to the point that they want to kill themselves, they should be allowed to die. Or the example they also gave was, like, an athlete who got a spinal injury and couldn't walk, was so depressed that he wanted to kill himself, too. I mean, where do you draw the line after you open the door to saying that if you have a terminal disease or a terminal illness, you can kill yourself?
That's a really good question. There's a case that Dr. Kevorkian, who's also known as Dr. Death, he lived in Michigan. He was going around breaking Michigan's assisted suicide law. So it's against the law. And just for legality, please no talking while I'm talking. In Michigan, it's against the law. In Oregon, doctor assisted suicide is legal. In Washington, the same thing. And Montana also recently legalized assisted suicide. Every place in the U.S., it's illegal. Michigan was one of these places. And there was this woman, Jeanette Atkinson, who was in the early stages of Alzheimer's. So she had not suffered any of the effects of Alzheimer's. She'd just gotten some sort of temporary, you know, forgetfulness and some mild symptoms set on. The doctor said, well, what's going to happen is gradually you're going to lose all sense of self, you're going to lose your mind, you're going to be kind of free associating, you're not going to be able to think coherently, and eventually you're going to have, like, nervous system problems that are going to be catastrophic on your basic metabolic processes, and you're going to die. But before that, you won't even know who you are, you won't recognize your family members, and so on and so forth. All the terrible things that come with Alzheimer's, it's as a person, you slowly sort of, that your brain gets eaten away by the disease, and as that happens, you become eaten away, you know, as a person. And so she said, well, I'm not going to go through that. And so she, Dr. Gevorkian, hooked her up to the suicide machine where he had this sort of, I'm trying to remember which one it was, carbon monoxide or something. He had some sort of gizmo where the patient actually pushes a switch from saline solution to the deadly poison that kills them.
So they
them.
Make the choice themselves.
Yeah, so they're actually doing it. So it's not, he's not really assisting them. He's just presenting giving them a machine and the means to do it. And he ended up going to prison. But Jeanette Atkinson was a case that people point to and say, look, she still has good quality of life. She still has full cognitive function or pretty close to not much different than other people who are maybe a little older. And so that's a case where a lot of people got squeamish about it, even though generally they might have been in favor of it. Because that's a person who, because she thought it would be so terrible to have Alzheimer's, that she wanted to not, she didn't want to go through that experience and sort of go out early, as it were. Yeah.
Alzheimer's runs in my family, and I know that if I were presented, say I came up, started showing signs, and I've seen how it's gone throughout the generations of my family, and someone came to me and said, hey, why don't you come on in and we're going to go ahead and take care of you, I would do the exact same thing. There's no way in hell I would want to go through Alzheimer's. It's absolutely, you become a prisoner in your own body and you know no one. It's absolutely horrible, and I for sure would go in, and I'm not going to leave a mess for my husband to clean up or, my best friend, so yeah. I'm going to go.
Where do you draw the line, just out of curiosity? Like, do you just, like, do you pick diseases and say that if I had these certain diseases, I'll kill
myself?
I think
it's everybody's choice. No, if you were terrified of having AIDS and you got told that you did and you didn't want to go through it and you wanted to go ahead and end it, fine, do it. If you got...
What if I'm terrified of car crashes?
Fine.
Should I kill myself? Should I kill myself because I'm scared that one day I'll get in a car crash?
I think you should go through... Yeah, thank you.
Please,
I think that you should go through...
No, you shouldn't.
I think that you should go through some type of therapy.
No, I'm saying the makes me crazy is if you say a physical illness or disease, you don't even consider therapy.
If you're uncomfortable and you're in pain and or you're terrified to be in your own body, which happens to Alzheimer's patients, and before that happens, you are in a rational mind to say, you know what, I know what's coming and I don't want that to happen to me, then yeah, you have every fucking right to go in there and get
put down. But then you're also assuming you know what happens. I mean, you know that that's going to happen. Like, that's an inevitable thing. Somehow...
If you have that disease, it is.
I mean you don't know how long you're going to live. I mean, I've known people that have lived... Quality of life has been fine.
My grandma lived until she was 93 with Alzheimer's. She died of natural causes.
Okay.
But she was terrified.
Okay, that's personal. Now, psychologically, she can be
covered. I thought
she
was happy.
Yeah,
she was happy until her last month.
But you're putting the importance not on physical suffering. You're putting the importance in psychological suffering. You're saying that she's terrified. And if you present people with other irrational things that they're scared of, the dark, whatever, you say, get counseling, get comforting. I mean,
there's no counseling for Alzheimer's.
No, but I'm saying the psychological comfort. The comfort of having family around you when you're dying is much greater than being abandoned.
Let me step in here. I make an executive, use my executive power here, instructor, and there's a couple of people with their hands up, and you were first.
Yeah, well, if we go back to the fundamental right of life, liberty, and property,
mm-hmm.
Personal, everything aside, if you have the right to property, and you have the right to choose not to have property. If you have the right to liberty and you have the right to choose not to have liberty, if you want to sell yourself into slavery rather than be forced into it, why you don't have the choice to be born. But life, if you have a right to life, it seems like you should have the right to choose to. And if you have the right to free will all the way through your life, why not have that last decision?
Yeah, there was this argument in the text, which is kind of dense and philosophical, about the idea that making a free choice to end your life is somehow incoherent because you're making a choice to cut off all future free choices. So, but I think you make a persuasive case that you own yourself and you have a right to decide whether you want to continue to live or not, and you don't have, as has been pointed out, the right to live forever. You have a really like to live as long as you can because everybody's going to die at some point. The question is whether you're going to die now or later. And and whether, you know, whether you want to particularly suffer through a debilitating disease. But what if I want to kill myself because I'm going to lose my hair or something? Or just for some trivial reason. Then what would you think? You probably think there's something wrong with my mind because no one's going to kill themselves over going bald. Because there's lots of people that are bald and they're fine. But the thought is usually that something's wrong with, you know, there's something wrong with my mind and I should go to the therapy. And that the idea of tempting me helping me with my irrational desire to die based on a trivial reason would be something that would maybe be a violation of my rights in some way, taking advantage of the fact that I'm in a bad state of mind, that I have an irrational belief, maybe several irrational beliefs, and that's generally, I think, why people are squeamish about allowing people who are just kind of depressed or had some traumatic situation, because the idea is that, you know, when you experience a trauma, usually when it first happens, you feel really, really bad. But over time, the way the human brain works, the trauma and the pain, they lessen over time. Doesn't mean they go away, but they lessen. And so the idea is you just sort of wait long enough, the pain's going to go away. Whereas with a terminal illness, you might also argue that there's always that small little chance that you might have what they call spontaneous remission and you'll be well again and recover. Yeah.
So we're not going to talk about organs today.
No, not today. Oh, we'll have to wait till Tuesday. So we've talked about a lot of issues in assisted suicide. And in class here, I think too, you know, make sure to do the readings. I'm not going to go systematically over every aspect of the article. Make sure you look at the main pro and con articles. Feel free to bring those up in class as part of our debate here. And you know that stuff's gonna, in the text is going to show up. Just because we don't talk about it in class doesn't mean it's not going to be on the test. So make sure to read the article on abortion for Tuesday. And before we get to abortion, we're going to talk about selling your organs. First thing in Tuesday's class.